The secret to well-being is discovering the power that is your birthright, the power to create a happier, healthier life drawn from our own vast internal resources. Join Jules and her guests as they gently guide you to shift your perspective from the familiar negative to the divinely connected, a place that will not only positively impact your world, but possibly shift the planet. It's all right here on Law of Attraction Talk Radio.
Welcome to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I'm Jules from beautiful Southern California, and I'm so excited about tonight's show. We have New York Times bestselling author and internationally renowned pioneer in bridging science, spirituality, and the real world, Mr. Greg Braden, is with us tonight. Normally, I would give you a commentary beforehand, but Greg has so much information for us that I want to get right to the interview. So let's do it. Let me give you an introduction to Greg, though. Greg Braden, following a successful career as a computer geologist for Phillips Petroleum during the 1970s energy crisis, worked as a senior computer systems designer with Martin Marietta Defense Systems during the last years of the Cold War. For more than 27 years, Greg has searched high mountain villages, remote monasteries, and forgotten texts to uncover their timeless secrets. His work is now featured as media specials on the History Channel, Discovery Channel, National Geographic, ABC, and NBC. To date, Greg's discoveries have led to a paradigm-shattering books as The God Code, The Divine Matrix, Fractal Time, and his newest, Deep Truth, Igniting the Origin of Our Origin, History, Destiny, and Fate. Now, The Divine Matrix was selected as the source for the made-for television featured Entanglement, and is also the textbook for college-level courses exploring new discoveries of science and our relationship to the world. Today, Greg's work is published in 38 languages and 33 countries and shows us beyond any reasonable doubt that the key to our future lies in the wisdom of our past. This is so exciting. Welcome, Greg, to Law of Attraction Talk Radio. I am so delighted to have you back on my show.
I am thrilled to be with you today. This is my first interviews, my first series of interviews in the new year of 2013. And I think I speak for a lot of people when I say we're happy 2012 is behind us. It was a good year in many respects, and I think we're all happy to move on to the possibilities of 2013 and beyond.
Oh, I agree. Greg, I have to mention before we really get into anything that I walked right by you on the dirt path in Tulum on December 15th when I was there with my Law of Attraction cruise.
Well, you may have walked right by. I didn't see you when you walked by, and I was a bit overwhelmed by all of the media that was there, and I probably kept walking.
Well, don't feel bad, because you were in such deep conversation with another person that I did not want to interrupt. And I knew that we were going to be interviewing today, so I was going to save up all my questions.
All right, Jules. So just for the record, next 5,125-year-long cycles completion, when we meet at Tulum, feel free to come up and say hello and interrupt if I'm in conversation, okay?
I'll remember all that right. In 5,000 years, I promise. Hey, you know what? I will do that.
All right.
So tell me, how was your travels in Mayan country? What did you come away with?
You know, it was very interesting. I was there, when you saw me, I was there with I had a group. We had been there for 2 weeks in the Yucatan Peninsula, many sites from near the Guatemalan border all the way over to Tulum, where you saw us. There were a lot of expectations that the world had imposed upon the Mayan sites in that part of the world, and it was interesting for me and our group, and this was a truly international group. We had people from 17 different countries on this trip, so I had the perspective of those people from their respective parts of the world. And what I found very quickly is that it meant different things to different people. The Mayans themselves were amazed at the attention that their lives, their lifestyles, and their history was being given by the world. They were also amazed at the reasons that people were coming, because from the Mayan perspective, the Mayans themselves, this was not the end of anything other than a cycle of time that has
right.
come and gone many times in the past. So they were amazed at some of the expectations, and especially from the media, the film crews, that were there asking about the end of the world, the end of life, the end of all these things. And it didn't make sense to them because, and this is, I think, one of the keys to understanding the indigenous perspectives throughout the world, and the Mayan specifically, is that the Maya people, they never separated themselves from the world around them, number one. They never separated the cycles of nature and time from cycles of human experience. And they never separated art from science, from spirituality, from everyday life. And when you take those three factors into consideration, it helps us to understand their view on the world. And Jules, one of the really interesting things I asked the group to do, how different would our world be if we did not separate art from science, from spirituality, from everyday life? Think about what that would mean. It holds fascinating possibilities of renewing our sense of creativity that we have among ourselves, not trying to separate what we do creatively from what we do for a living, not separating the beauty that touches and moves and inspires us inside of our bodies, changes the chemistry of our bodies because of the way we feel about the beauty, not separating that from the science that helps us to understand why those things happen the way they do. It really opens the door to a lot of possibilities. Mm-hmm. So all of this, when we arrived and we worked with Mayans directly, we worked with some of the Mayan elders, some that Western people would call a shaman, mm-hmm. although the Mayans themselves didn't particularly use that word. And what they were especially happy about is that for whatever reason, the focus of the world was on their art, their history, their lives, and the beginning of a new world age mm-hmm. that opens the door to cooperation and peace between the peoples and nations of the world. And they were very excited about that.
Oh, I agree. We could feel the locals' excitement. It was so wonderful. You know, my group had studied about the Mayan culture, and what they were saying was going to happen through Akta, one of their Mayan elders. And it was fascinating that we got to sit and meditate and do exactly what he had instructed us to do, to feel the earth and to give back to the earth through the soles of our feet. It was so fascinating, very humbling, and goes along with what you just said about you and I meeting in 5,000 years in Tulum again. Our group felt that at one time in one life, we were all together, and we made a promise and a contract that we would meet up in our homeland on December 15th, the same day we saw you in Tulum. So it was a fabulous experience, really life-changing for me. So, Greg, what happened on December 21st, 2012?
Nothing. Nothing out of the ordinary, and that's what makes it so beautiful. From the Mayan perspective, and also from the perspective of science, the December 21st, 2012, marked a date on the Mayan calendar specifically, and the Mesoamerican calendars in general, throughout the desert Southwest, all the way down through Mexico, through Latin America, into parts of South America, they've all used this system of timekeeping,
right.
And it's based on Earth's location in space, and Earth's tilt, angle, wobble, orbit, and how that changes our relationship to our own sun. As well as the central sun at the center of the Milky Way galaxy, as well as the Milky Way itself. And when we talk about those kinds of alignments, they are such huge systems Jules, that they cannot possibly happen in one day. So for so many people, they were expecting, anticipating, fearing, and the media played into this a lot, that when that alignment on that day, something bad was going to happen, when in truth, the alignment has been present for months prior to that date, and we're still in the alignment now. These are huge systems. They don't turn on a dime. So just to be very clear with our listeners, that it's interesting where these dates come from. There's a huge 26,000-year cycle called the precession of the equinoxes, and if our listeners are not familiar with that, they're familiar with what it encompasses, and that is the astrological cycles. The age of Pisces, the age of Aquarius, the age of Taurus. Each one of those is roughly a 2,000-year window in this 26,000-year, a little over 2,000 years in this 26,000-year cycle. Our ancestors somehow knew that, and they divided that huge cycle into smaller cycles, five smaller cycles of about 5,125 years. So what was being celebrated on December 21st was the fifth of those 5,125-year cycles, and it began on a very precise date. It was August 11th, 3114 BC. There was a rare astronomical alignment. Our ancestors noted it. Chinese astronomers noted it. We know that it was real, and our computers can now back calculate and tell us that it actually happened. And what they told us, and this is what's so amazing, was that exactly 1,872,000 days later, we would go through another alignment, exactly 1,872,000 days. And that 1,872,000th day from August 11th, 3114 BC, happened to be precisely on the solstice of December 21st. So that's where the date came from. So we've been on a countdown for the last 1,872,000 days. That's 5,125 years. We've been on a countdown. And with the Mayans, I sarcastically say nothing, because actually there's a whole lot happening, not about that date, but it's about our time in history.
Right.
The Mayans knew that when we reach that place in the cycle, Earth's location in space would change, as it has many times in the past, because it is a cycle, and that change would change the way we live in our world. They knew it would change the climate. Because it has in the past, and our geologic records confirm that. So when the climate changes globally, that means local weather changes.
Mm-hmm.
And that means we experience extremes in terms of hot and cold, when it rains, when it doesn't, when it snows, when it doesn't. And that affects the way we grow our food and how we share vital resources, and that affects the way we treat one another as we go through these cycles. So it's no surprise that our ancestors linked these things together. They linked the cycle and the close of the cycle, December 21st, with a change in the way things would be here in our world. And the question they asked themselves, and that we're asking ourselves now, it's not about whether it's the end of the world or not. It simply is the end of a way of being. And what is happening right now, I think it's precisely what we're witnessing in our world. Unsustainable ways of thinking, unsustainable ways of living are collapsing around us, from the economies of the world to the way we deal with corporations, the way we fuel our planet, the way we create power and electricity on our planet, the way we share resources. The unsustainable ways of doing those things in the past are, in fact, collapsing. And the question now becomes, how do we treat one another as we go through those experiences, as we go through the end of this cycle? And the Mayans said very clearly, and the elders say it today, it's not the end of the world. It's the end of what's called a world age.
Right.
And by definition, it's the beginning of what comes next. It's not the end of life. It's the end of unsustainable ways of living that no longer work. And the question is, will we give in to the fear of the uncertainty of what lies before us and fall back on the very thinking that has led to the problems to try to solve the crises of the world? Or can we let the past go? Can we let the thinking and the ideas, the false assumptions of science, can we let those things go and embrace what the new discoveries, the new science is showing us about the deepest truths, our relationship to the world, and move forward and embrace the new possibilities. So our ancestors said it very clearly. Our own science is saying it in another language. They're saying the same thing. And when you ask what happened on December 21st, it was a day pretty much like every other day. However,
right.
it marked in time, visually, a point in the history of civilization, the history of Earth, and in the cycles of nature, precisely plunked down right in the middle of when we see the changes happening in our lives and our world right now.
Mm.
So, you know, the question is, what is the media going to make the media specials about now? What is Discovery and History Channel? 2012 is gone. I think the next thing you're talking about is an asteroid that's out there somewhere. But
oh, yes, I'm hearing all kinds of stories. I'm still hearing the zombies things are coming out because of deadly viruses.
I haven't heard that one, but, you know, I don't get out much. So, see, I go to the Yucatan, I come home and write books, and I do lecture tours, but I'm not out in the world like you are. So,
well,
you may know more about that than I do, but it was a really exciting time to be in the Yucatan. And what was interesting, there were people in other parts of Mexico, northern Mexico, that had never experienced this part of their own country.
Oh,
that
wow.
were flocking from northern Mexico into the Yucatan to learn of their own history, their own culture, a part of their own nation that they had never had the opportunity to explore before, and people from other parts of Latin America coming up from Bolivia and Peru and Ecuador and Chile for the same reason, and for the first time, many people in Mexico were actually seeing their brothers and sisters who were bound by blood and by the common history of the Spanish they'd never seen before, and they to sit around and listen to them share their stories and their experiences and how they're trying to keep their culture alive
right.
and preserve their traditions in the modern world. I think that was part of the untold story of 2012 and what happened in the Yucatan.
Oh, yeah. It was wonderful. It was wonderful. But, you know, I, for one, I'm kind of grateful to the media and all that fear, because it did put a focus in on we need to start shifting to a different way of thinking.
Sure, sure.
And so in that respect, it's all good. And I think, well, for example, I do think that there was a huge shift that occurred because of that link that you sent out on your newsletter about the Israeli man telling Iran that I love you. I have nothing against you.
Sure.
And that went viral. And people are picking up saying, wait a minute, there is no need for war. We're not powerless over our governments. We're powerful in that we can say no more.
Well, absolutely. And that was happening. That's been happening. And it happened. It was happening in the months leading up to December 21st. It's happening now. For listeners who may not be familiar with the conversation that we're having right now, there is my first newsletter of the year went out. I think it was last week.
Yeah, it was great.
And there was a reference to something that's happening in the Middle East right now, and I shared it only as an example. Of one of many examples of what's possible right now. And I think if you're listening to this program, you are probably aware that right now, early 2013, in some circles there's a big push for a war in the Middle East.
Mm.
It's a war I believe never need happen. There are a lot of reasons that we're being told in the media that the war is necessary on the one hand, and on the other hand, the best science of our time, and I share this in the book, Deep Truth, the best science of our time has now shown us peer-reviewed science. This isn't speculation or a hypothesis or theory. It's a fact that nature is actually based upon a model very different from what we've been led to think of and believe in the past. We've grown up in the 20th century, if you're listening to this program, most of us, to believe that we live in a world of scarcity, of competition, And in Darwin's own words, from the book he released in 1859, survival of the strongest. So we've been conditioned to believe we live, most of us, in what's called a dog-eat-dog world,
right,
where there's one pie, we've got to fight for our slice, and if we don't, the world's going to run right over us. And that thinking, survival of the strongest, is at the crux of the systems that are collapsing right now. The global economy, for example, the way the corporations have been implemented, the way that we are sharing resources and exploiting resources, all about this idea of survival of the strongest. Well, the new science is done a 180, and peer-reviewed publications, very prestigious journals such as Nature, New Scientist, for example, are telling us that nature is based upon a model of what is called mutual aid and cooperation, and that while we do see violent competition sometimes in nature, it's not the model. It is in response to specific conditions, but it's not the model that nature is based upon. So the reason that's important is because we're trying to solve these big problems in the world today through the thinking of the last century that says everything is separate and that we live in this world of competition. But there is a new thinking that's emerging, and this thinking reflects this idea of cooperation and mutual aid. So an example of that, a beautiful real-life example that takes this whole conversation out of the realm of theory and notes into the real world, is that there was an artist, a graphic artist, 41 years old in Israel, and he wrote an open letter to the people of Iran. And what he said is this: there's talk of a war. He said, they're talking about us like it's not even us. He said, for us to have a war, he said, I must hate you. And he said, I can't hate you because I don't even know you. Mm-hmm. I've never even met an Iranian. And then there's a little aside. He says, I met one in the museum in Paris. Nice dude. I think it's pretty funny. He said, people of Iran, the Israelis would never hurt you. We love you. And he sent this off. Within 24 hours, people of Iran, through social media, responded and said, people of Israel, we love you. We don't want a war with you. We can't have a war with you unless we hate you. We can't hate you because we don't even know you. No Israelis have ever done us any harm. And this interaction between these two groups, the way it concludes, is that they believe, and I believe this as well, I believe that we are living a phenomenal generation. We are about to witness the first generation in recorded human history that will walk away from the use of war to solve our large-scale problems. Mm. And I believe that we're going to see the first example where we turn our back in war and walk away in the Middle East. What is happening? The people of Israel and Iran said in this open exchange, they said, the people of Israel, the people of Iran will lead the world to peace. Mm. And there's such a powerful possibility. The war is not supported by the people of either nation or the world.
Or the world.
And it's one example of how this, our truest nature of cooperation is playing out. And it's not to say that we don't have differences and problems. And I'm not judging the wars of the past. You know, the wars of the 20th century, it was a different world. We thought differently. Different things were going on. I'm not going to say they're right, wrong, good, or bad. We're here today. So whatever we've done in the past, to whatever degree has worked, to the degree in met the needs of the time, and it got us here today, and now we're saying, does the way of the past, does it make sense to think that way today? And the answer is no. So this is one example, and it's a beautiful example. So I sent the link out through our newsletter, and it has gone viral. Now there's a follow-up to this that you don't know about. So can I share that
story? Oh, please.
One of the women that you saw me with in the Yucatan for 2012 is an Israeli citizen. And I shared the video during the seminar when we were there. She was absolutely in tears at the end of this film because she lives this every day under the threat and the fear of preparation for war. She was so touched, she went back to her country and she tracked down the man who made the film and had lunch with him, told him that how much support he has in other parts of the world, told him that we were sending his film out, had her picture taken with him. I'm going to share it in a seminar I'm doing in Conscious Life Expo in Los Angeles this next week. Our people there will see this. And it was an amazing opportunity for her to take something she didn't know anything about, go back, and then take the action, the next step, track this man down, and help him to understand how much support he had in the world. He had no idea. He had no idea that he had the kind of support in his thinking and in the possibilities. And now it's encouraged him to take this one step further. And there's follow the link on the site that it's on my website, gregbraden.com. It's on the newsletter. Or you can probably just go to Google. And there are a number of different versions of the video out there. But if people will Google Israel Loves Iran, something along those lines, the YouTube, you'll have a number of YouTube films that will come up, different versions of this original video. And what it shows, the governments, that the people of the world, I think, are ready for more than the war and the suffering that has been so customary in the 20th century. And we're so conditioned to accepting it in the way we think that it's probably not going to be supported. It won't be supported going forward into this new century. I want to say just a couple of words about governments as well.
Please,
There's a tendency to demonize many of the governments of the world, and I'm not denying there obviously are governments there that are cruel, that are dictatorial, and that are greedy, and I'm not going to deny that that's happening. But I'm also going to say, I haven't met a lot of world leaders. I've met some. And my sense is that for the most part, I think they try to be good people. They try to be the best people they can in the circumstances that they're given. And what I'm seeing, and it's amazing to see this happen, is that I think many of the leaders are stuck. They're stuck in a thinking, in a world that changed faster than they were prepared to embrace or deal with. And they're still trying to solve the problems of today through a thinking that was here 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they're struggling with that and where that fits, and at the same time trying to stay in office. I mean, it's a reality that they face. So whatever we can do to create an environment where cooperation is supported, where mutual aid is supported, I think it makes it easier for many of the world leaders to create policies then that mirror that. And I think we're seeing that play out on the world stage as well. The fact that there's been no military intervention yet in the Middle East, and some of the policies that are changing between nations that have been very quick to go in militarily are now sitting back, and they're resorting to at least exploring other ways of solving the problems rather than using the military option as the first option.
Right.
And I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing behind the scenes. I'm encouraged by what I see publicly. And I'm also a realist, Jules. You know, I'm not looking at this through a world of rosy glasses. I think there is a beautiful, awakened, transformed world that lies before us. And there's a bridge that will get us there. And we are in the process of crossing that bridge right now.
Mm-hmm.
And to bring everyone along to the other side of that bridge, we're being asked to do something that we've never been asked to do before. And that is we're being asked to think differently and to think more differently, more radically, than we've ever been asked to think before in a very brief period of time. We're not talking about generations. We're talking about this generation changing the way it's been led to think and act, not in terms of decades, but in terms of a few months or a couple of years.
Mm.
Because that's when the decisions for this war are going to be made. That's when decisions will be made that will determine if the global economy actually collapses. And when we talk about the economy, I know for a lot of our listeners, in my experiences, people's eyes kind of glaze over because they think the economy is all about money. Money probably is the smallest aspect of what an economy is all about. The economy is the glue that holds the fabric of our communities and societies of the world together so that we can share and exchange the resources that are vital to us and our families and our health, our well-being, and our survival. And when that economy doesn't work, everyone is impacted by that. And that's why it's so important. You can have an economy and have no money.
Mm.
So it's not about money per se, although money is an expression that many people are looking at right now. But this is about the way we treat one another as we go through big changes. And those decisions are being made within a matter of months rather than a matter of years. So clearly, we've got our work cut out for us. We're being asked to think differently. And based upon that new thinking, to embrace the deepest truths of what our own science is revealing. We've asked science to tell us who we are and how things work in the world. Science is revealing the answers. Now our job is to embrace what those truths are, and it is a choice. Many people are rejecting those truths. And this is why I wrote the book, Deep Truth, because so much of the science is there, but mainstream is refusing to share the science with the broad general public. Mainstream media, mainstream classrooms, mainstream textbooks.
Yes.
And we've talked about that a little bit in the past, and we can talk about it some more. So I just covered a lot of ground. I want to lay this out as we go into our program today so we can tie back into these specific things, but we also have a context for why all these things are important.
Greg, let me ask you your opinion, because, you know, we're about the law of attraction and the quantum physics and what we observe we can affect. So are we, in fact, putting our head in the sand when we stop watching the news? Are we taking the focus on what is not working and choosing to focus in on what is working? Is that how we're supposed to do this? I'm just wondering if it's better to observe without fear and focus on something more positive. Is that the new way of thinking?
Well, you just asked me three questions in that question.
I'm sorry.
So to begin with, from my perspective, this is my opinion.
Yes.
So I always like to make it very clear what is the science and what's the Gregism. I believe we're not necessarily supposed to be doing anything.
Okay.
I think it's all about choice.
Good.
If we choose an awakened world and a transformed world, that means we are also choosing awakened and transformed lives. Watching the news, if we stop watching, do we have our head in the sands? It depends on how we stop watching. The media that we see in the West today is largely owned by just a handful of corporations.
Right.
And it's very, very difficult to get an objective view of what's going on in the world. So much of the media now is commentary.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to be very, very selective on what is actually informational and what is commentary. I ask people, my wife and I, we stopped watching TV for a while, and I'm going to just share why it may not do any good. Because we stopped watching the news, we stopped watching television, and we travel all over the world, and every day somebody would come up and say, hey, did you see the news today? And I would say, no, because we stopped watching the news. And they said, well, let me tell you what you would have seen if you saw the news. So they're telling us, even though we're not watching. And I think if we want to stop watching the commentary, that's one thing. But if we can also make it a point to stay informed, then that is the flip side of the coin. If we can stay informed without watching the news, then the answer is no, we're not putting our head in the sand. If we just shut everything off, and go about living our lives day in and day out, I'm not going to say that's right, wrong, good, or bad. It's a personal choice. And the value, I think, of being aware, at least being aware of what's happening in the world, is that it helps put the things happening in our lives into context. So, for example, we live in a rural area in northern New Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
Our home is an hour from the nearest grocery store of any size, and 10 miles from the nearest gas station.
Wow.
So we go into town, go into the gas station, and I pay the guy at the pump. And what he sees is the gas is going up, but he has, because he is unplugged, he's chosen not to watch any news, not to be aware of the world. It's a mystery for him why the price of the food is increasing, why his dollar is buying less, why the price of gas is going up. It's a mystery for him why his kids, who are in other cities in school, why their education has gone sky high. It doesn't make any sense to him. So his choice to unplug, the question is, has it served him? Mm-hmm. If he's a happier and healthier man because of that, I would say yes. Because it's creating frustration in his life, it may serve him better at least to be aware, mm-hmm. to be aware of the world, the larger world, so we can see where we fit in that larger world in the context of our lives. So does that make any sense?
Yes.
Say it that way?
Yes. Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. But if we're feeling the fear, that's not good at all, is it?
Well, the fear comes from not knowing.
Oh, yes.
And this is part of the value of being aware. And again, it depends on how we choose to be aware. People ask me all the time, you know, Greg, where's a good place to go for world information? I've yet to find a single source. Mm. And so I make it a point to scour sources that I've found over the years, and it depends on what country I'm in. We can look at news sources in other parts of the world. The same story, very different commentary.
Absolutely.
So BBC, for example, CNN International is very different from CNN Domestic.
Yes.
And they actually do a nice job. I was just in... I was in Australia. I was in the Yucatan when I'm in Europe. The CNN International desk does a very, very different perspective from what many of the domestic CNN anchors are actually looking at.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, but it is. It is. It's an effort that we have to put forth for ourselves to keep ourselves informed. And even when you see something happening in the world, and you see it through the media, what we always have to keep in mind is that what we're being shown is that media outlet's perspective, mm-hmm. of what's happening. So you have to kind of keep those in mind. You can get an idea of the events, but the specifics, each media outlet will emphasize what they feel is important. So there's an art and a skill to gathering and distilling information in a way that's meaningful in our lives.
So what way are we supposed to be looking at the future? What are we supposed to be... We're not supposed to be looking at the past and the way we thought before. How are we supposed to be changing the way we think?
Well, I'm going to go back to something I shared just a few moments ago. My perspective is we're not supposed to be doing anything.
Okay.
But the opportunity is there for us if we choose. If we believe... that we're creating our world, and if we believe that that the future is the result of choices and beliefs in the present, this is where it makes sense to embrace facts, the facts of what science is sharing with us today. This is the value of science.
Okay.
Science clearly doesn't have all the answers. I was trained as a scientist, and what I know is that science is lacking in many places, and if you look to science for all the answers, we're going to be very disappointed. But what science does, science can give us the nuts and bolts and the facts of how things work in the world. Then it's up to us to apply those facts in a meaningful way in our lives, and that's where wisdom comes in. Science can't give us wisdom, but the wisdom can come from our life experience. It comes as we stand on the shoulders of 5,000 years of our ancestors and what they have come to understand about our relationship to the world and their lives. A lot of the ideas, I have to tell you, Jules, they're old ideas, but they're not obsolete. They're very current. And science is actually reiterating many of our most cherished and ancient indigenous traditions in the language of science, saying that we are all connected, and that what happens in one place does affect what's happening somewhere else, and that we do have the ability to change the course and the direction and the trajectory of where we're heading in our personal lives as well as collectively. So having said that, what I'll say is this. The best minds of our time tell us that we're facing the greatest number of crises ever to face a single generation in 5,000 years of history. And every crisis that they have identified, the solutions already exist for every one of those crises. We already have the answers. The missing link, and perhaps the greatest crisis that no one's really talking about, is the crisis in thinking. the thinking that stands between us in implementing life-affirming, transformative solutions in our lives and in our world, solutions of equality, solutions that, that end the suffering of so many people in the world. Those possibilities are, already exist. So I think our job, if you're asking about what's possible for us, is as we embrace what the new discoveries are showing us, then it only makes sense to follow through with the solutions. Until we embrace that way of thinking, the solutions, there's a disconnect. The solutions don't make sense to us. So, for example, we already have, and we might want to get into this in a longer program, but I'm just going to say it briefly. We have sources of energy, for example, that eliminate the use of fossil fuels altogether.
Right.
And that make it possible for every family on the face of the earth to have the energy they need to heat their homes or cool their homes, depending on where they live, to cook their food, and provide the lighting and the power they need for their lives. We don't have to revert to a primitive lifestyle to reduce the kinds of carbon emissions that we're trying to reduce right now. But the principles for some of the ideas for the power that's out there, they're very unconventional. And the thinking in the mainstream right now simply has been resistant to those ideas. Of course, that's changing. But that is... I was a geologist in the 1970s. I worked for Phillips Petroleum, Denver, Colorado. In the 1970s, Jules, there were carburetors that could get over 90 miles to the gallon.
Wow.
For automobiles, for passenger automobiles. And those patents were bought up by big companies that said, we can't possibly allow a carburetor that gets 90 miles to the gallon to be on the market. What would that do to the price of everything we're working for? And that was in the 70s. So think of where things are right now. If we even want to stay with an internal combustion engine. But one of the things to keep in mind, and as a scientist, I find this fascinating because I have researched in depth the life of many scientists, inventors and innovators of the last 100 years. And many of the technologies that we use today that are now causing the problems, so the way we generate electricity, for example, the way we generate light in our light bulbs, the internal combustion engine, these are three examples. The inventors themselves, when they shared their discoveries with the world, were very clear that these were meant as temporary devices. They were never meant to be the destination of the technology. They were meant as a bridge to help make life better for the people of the world until the new technology could be developed and implemented.
Interesting.
But somehow, and I don't mean you, me, or our listeners, but we, the general population, we forgot that.
Mm-hmm.
And we began to believe that making little explosions inside of a cast iron block to make your car go, which is what's happening in every cylinder of an internal combustion engine, that's the only way it can be done. So here we are, almost 100 years later, and what we've done is tremendously refined and made more efficient the same idea that was introduced. We never got to the next step. The same idea with light bulbs, the same idea with the way we share electricity.
Mm-hmm.
It was never meant to be the destination, and what we've done is we've stretched the limits of what were meant to be temporary technological solutions to the point where they're now collapsing because they're no longer sustainable.
So are we going to be able to see free energy soon, or is it still going to be controlled by the corporations?
Well, you know, realistically, I'm a realist. Corporations aren't going to go away.
Yes.
And there is a world that awaits, I think, where those things have changed, and to get to that world, there's going to be a bridge. And I think we're seeing an energy revolution in the world with cleaner, although not 100% clean, forms of energy. I think we're seeing cleaner forms of energy. And I think the corporations are going to be where the transformation happens. So rather than seeing corporations as the enemy, and there's definitely corruption, and they definitely the systems are broken, and they definitely need to be fixed. And please don't get me wrong on that. But what I'm seeing is inside the corporations that have the farthest reach, the greatest resources to develop the technologies and bring them to the forefront the fastest, there are some brilliant minds at the heights of within those corporations, and they're putting a lot of money and energy into doing just that. The corporations may actually, and I'm not saying every single corporation, but they may become our closest allies to actually bringing forward on a large scale the kinds of things we're talking about. How else could it happen?
Wow.
And I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing along those lines as well. And it's not being made public. The media demonizes and zeroes in and focuses in on specific elements of things they don't like to the exclusion of a lot of the good things that are out there.
Yes.
And I think that's a lot of where this shift in thinking is changing. And I'm a realist. There definitely is greed. There definitely is corruption. Some of the systems are definitely so broken, I don't see how we can repair them. On the one hand, and on the other hand, there are huge corporations out there that are making huge inroads, taking the money that they have made from conventional forms of energy, and it takes a lot of money, a lot of exploration, a lot of resources to find new ways of doing things. I'm seeing it happen in the armed services. Some of the Air Force research facilities you don't hear about. In the civilian research facilities, Lawrence Livermore Labs, Sandia National Labs, for example, in Albuquerque, New Mexico, they are pioneering forms of energy that sound like Star Trek stuff, and they're the ones that are doing this so quickly. I think it's going to come on the scene much quicker than what we've been led to believe in the past.
Wow.
So we're crossing the bridge, and I think one of the keys is if we can do this by, and I think this serves us, this is, again, my opinion, and it's also my experience, if we can look at the past without judging the past,
mm-hmm.
I think it serves us to move forward in the spirit of precisely what we're talking about, the cooperation it takes to get to this new world, rather than demonizing and causing so many hard feelings between so many different entities that it makes that cooperation almost impossible.
Wow.
So I think that, and I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing, but again, the media doesn't pick up on that. In the real world, I'm seeing it happen, and I'm encouraged by what I'm seeing.
Greg, I just have to ask you with the scientific mind and left brain, tell me, what's the scoop on UFOs?
All right, well, we may find. Do they exist? I don't know for a fact. I've seen things in the sky that I certainly couldn't explain in the high deserts of northern New Mexico that were silent, motionless, hovering. Where they come from, I don't know the answer to that. But where I think this really gets interesting, and it'll actually tie in to precisely where this conversation began, is for a very long time, there were only two nations on the face of the earth that had the money and the technology to explore other worlds, and that was the United States and former Soviet Union, now Russia. Both of those countries, economically, can't afford to do this any longer. New nations now are stepping up. China, for example, and India are two nations that have a rapidly developing manned space program. They will probably be back on the moon before any American or any Russian astronaut or cosmonaut make that trip. The reason this is important is because the satellite photographs and the imagery that has been coming back for decades now has shown what appear to be intentional structures in some of the crater areas on the moon, and there are depending on which accounts you are reading and which films you're seeing, some American astronauts who have even talked about seeing things that were unexpected and unconventional.
Edgar Mitchell, yes.
On the moon. So when people hear about the possibility of structures on the moon, and I've seen the photographs, and when you look from the satellite images, if you look at the images of ancient civilizations in the deserts on Earth, and you look at the images on the moon, you can't tell them apart. the structures look very, very similar. They have 90-degree angles for walls, which you find rarely in nature. Intentional geometry, that's the key to human structures. So when you hear that, people immediately say, E.T. has been there before, you know, life in other worlds. And that certainly is possible. But I think there's another possibility that may have an even greater impact upon the people of the Earth, and that is this. The new science, the new archaeology, is now revealing the evidence of advanced civilizations over twice as old as what we've been led to believe, the age of advanced civilizations on the Earth. We've been led to believe that civilization began about 5,000 years ago, and there's peer-reviewed evidence, published evidence, now that pushes that date back into the end of the last ice age. My sense is that when those scientists from China or India or whatever nation it is, when they step foot on another world and they see evidence of advanced civilizations there, what they're actually going to be seeing is evidence from us, from another cycle of human civilization, another cycle of human existence, where we work together as a world, and in our cooperation, we're able to achieve great things then. And then the question will be, if we were able to do that then, what could we accomplish if we put an end to war and begin working together and cooperate now? And I think we're going to have the answer to that question within this generation. And it opens up also a whole new realm of possibilities. Are those archaeological sites that the satellite photographs appear to indicate in the craters of the moon, are they human? And if they are, from another cycle, they're being estimated, the dates are being estimated about 50,000 years old. The question is, who on Earth was able to go and build something like that 50,000 years ago? And that opens up the whole conversation of advanced civilization cycles in the past, what was accomplished then, what we can accomplish now, and it puts our time and history into a bigger context. And it may be something like that, a powerful revelation of that nature that actually opens our eyes to the possibilities of what we can have if we can stop war, if we can stop fighting one another and honor our truest relationship to nature, and that is a relationship of cooperation and mutual aid. So That's my perspective on where the UFO experience may be taking us.
I love it. I love it. You know, going back to the Mayans, they believed that they came from an ancient or an extraterrestrial form.
Most indigenous peoples of the world do. I was trained as a scientist in the mid-1980s. I began exploring what I believed were the most ancient, isolated, remote, and pristine places remaining on the Earth today, with the thinking that if I could find places least disturbed by the modern world, that the information would be more intact. And that journey continues to this day, and it's led me from the Himalayas throughout the mountains of Egypt and Bolivia and Peru and the monasteries of Tibet into the Yucatan over recent years, all through South America. And one of the common themes I've found, Jules, is that almost universally our ancestors, they say, none of them say they're from this world. They all say that they're the children of another world. And interestingly, the star systems that they point to are pretty much the same star systems. They're pointing to Sirius, the Sirian star system, and the Mayans point to the Pleiadian star system, of which they believe our sun is a part of. They say that we're actually in the Pleiadian star system looking at the rest of the system from our perspective. We're in one of the stars in the tail. So that's not scientific, but it's almost universal. And the creation stories are so very similar.
Yes.
Almost universally from the Quechua and the people of the Lake Titicaca area that straddles Bolivia and Peru to the high deserts of the American Southwest. They look to the high elevation lakes, Lake Titicaca or Blue Lake up in northern New Mexico or wherever it might be. And they say that in the beginning, a being from another world went to into that lake, was never seen again, and from that being sprang the original male and female of which they are the descendants. And it's interesting how common and universal that story is from so many diverse populations living in high elevation and near these bodies of water that they consider sacred. So,
wow. Wow, that is so cool. Before we're almost out of time, but I want to congratulate you on being awarded the 2012 Elevated Existence Spiritual Service Award. And you have a story behind that award, too, because when you accepted it, it was right during Sandy hurricane, wasn't it?
I was there. It was in New Jersey is where I was, and it was the week that Sandy hit. And the hotel where the seminar was scheduled was had no power, no lights. The area was just devastated. And I fully expected the event would cancel, and I was happy to reschedule. And the producer and the people called, and everyone wanted to go forward with it, first of all, just to get people into a place where they were warm and dry.
Oh, yeah.
And secondly, they felt like having this seminar with the topic very similar to what we're sharing right now, the deep truths of science, and the essence of cooperation would help them to establish a form of normalcy in their lives, because it was something that was planned before the hurricane ever hit. They all wanted to go forward with it. So I went, and driving from the nearest airport, because so many of them were closed down, it was like a war zone. I know many of our listeners have been there, and they know exactly what it looks like. I was amazed that they opted to go forward with this. The electricity did come back on the afternoon of the seminar. When we went back in there, and the services were minimal, and the Elevated Service Award happened in the foyer of the hotel, the seminar. There's a film, I think it's on my website, in the newsletter that just went out. You can hear a lot of the background noise of people scurrying, trying to get the seminar put together before it actually began that evening. So I was very honored to receive this. I'm in good company. Wayne Dyer, I believe, is a recipient last year.
Yes.
Louise Hay,
yes.
Was the year before. You probably know more about the award than I do.
Well, I am delighted that you were chosen, because I think you are so worthy of it. What you have done to enhance the merging of science and spirituality is beyond words. We are able to look at life in a different light because of you, Greg, and I just think you're wonderful. And I promised you that I would get you off of the radio in time, because you have some other interviews to do. But I am so thrilled that I got to talk to you, especially after our trip to Tulum.
Well, Jules Johnson, I want to thank you for being such a gracious host. I'm now reflecting on the last hour and realizing I did most of the talking. So I appreciate you letting me share the story and share the context and the perspective that I have. And I want to thank you once again. And I know I've mentioned this in the past, but for the work you do and for your vision and for being such a powerful hub in your community, and that community that keeps growing and spreading. Just by the lives of the people that live in every day, what they come to experience in this program, that's where the change really begins. So I want to thank you for all you do to help us to be the best we can be and help create a better world. Thank you so much for what we've done today.
Oh, thank you. And I am delighted to say that we are heard in 125 countries. So we're connecting everyone together, you and I. Thank you so much for coming on with us today.
You're so welcome. Take good care.
Ooh, that was fun. I really enjoyed that interview, and I hope you did too. So to all my wonderful listeners out there, have a great week. We'll be back with another terrific show on Law of Attraction Talk Radio. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much for joining us. We'll be back next week with another great show from Law of Attraction Talk Radio. If you'd like to comment on tonight's show, send an email to Jules@LOARadionetwork.com and have a great week.